Music of Ziggy Marley, who was on the People's Game show just in the 5 o'clock hour. Interview that we recorded yesterday with Ziggy Marley. He had come back from South Africa where he attended a number of matches and played a free concert for the people of Soweto. It was a very interesting story as he told about that. This is Alan Minsky, and this is The People's Game, KPFK Radio's coverage of the 2010 World Cup Soccer Tournament, the largest and most popular cultural event in the world. And we cover not only the games on the field, but also the cultural, political, economic, and social subtexts of the 2010 World Cup tournament in South Africa. Later in the hour, we're going to be joined by Jennifer Doyle, the co-host of The People's Game, who is out and about in Los Angeles at a soccer salon, and she will report in from the soccer salon to this show. We will also hear from Richard Williams, the chief sports writer for The Guardian newspaper and website based out of London, England. He's been writing much about the World Cup soccer tournament, and we'll hear his thoughts about the tournament and the finals, which are coming up, of course, on Sunday. Again, I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined in studio this hour by two gentlemen, by Robert Edelman, an author and a professor that we have had on the People's Game show already. He is from University of California, San Diego, but he's up here for the day. He's the author of the award-winning book, Spartak Moscow, A History of the People's Team in the Workers' State. Welcome back to the People's Game, Bob.
Alan, I am thrilled and delighted to be here.
And we're also joined by Daniel Morales, who is the founder and executive director of Youth Empowerment through Scholastic Sports Services, YES. And Daniel Morales, welcome to the People's Game.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you for inviting me to your program.
And before we maybe talk about the particular focuses of you two gentlemen, which we'll get to across the hour, I think we should just maybe among the three of us have a conversation about the 2010 World Cup tournament, what we thought so far. And let's just throw it out like that. Daniel, Bob, maybe Daniel first. What do you make of the tournament so far?
Oh, I enjoyed the games. But I'm not enjoying what's behind the scenes, you know, like the economy things going on, making a lot of money. I mean, everybody's joining the games, but everybody is not working, especially Latin American at this time. The country from coming from, the government declared a day off when it's a good game as Mexico, Argentina. But I'm enjoying the games myself. Yeah.
And which country do you come from?
Guatemala.
Guatemala?
Yes.
Right. And actually, there was a little controversy around a Guatemalan referee and an ESPN commentator. Hector Tobar of the Los Angeles Times pointed out that he felt that the ESPN commentator was really being quite, I don't think, maybe Tobar used the term racist, but it was just being dismissive. I thought Tobar had a very good point. I don't know if you saw that article by Hector Tobar.
No, I didn't. But yeah. I heard about what Univision guys say about that referee that day. Yeah, it was really bad.
Right, yeah, it's a shame. Bob Edelman, what do you think of the tournament so far?
Actually, I wanted to ask you a question.
Sure, go ahead.
Would Pacifica have had a show like this at the last World Cup? Did you?
No, we didn't, and it's true that part of the rationale for the show is the fact that the tournament is in South Africa. And in that respect, as opposed to having – I mean, there are many reasons for it, but having the tournament in Germany – it didn't open up as many as sort of political, economic, and social questions.
I think my question that, you know, it's obviously raised by the World Cup, and I think the South Africa aspect has a lot to do with why we're so much more interested in it. I mean, ESPN has bought into, you know, and wrapped themselves around, you know, the side that was the good side, for better or for worse. I think in many cases for better. And it does remind people what went on there,
right?
And who was on which side when,
right?
And also the incredible complexities and ironies of the people who are flying in their private jets. You heard about this crush at the airport a couple of days ago because for the final, no, the semifinal. I forget which one it was, but so many big shots on private airplanes arrived at the airport that several fans who had already bought tickets and booked flights were not able to get to where the game was.
Yeah, and I suppose it might be a little, you think people would make it to the finals. Of course, it's a huge crowd. Soccer City is an absolutely massive stadium. And by the way, David Goldblatt, who you know, had just a marvelous description of Soccer City sort of hovering above Soweto. And of course, Soweto is incredibly impoverished, remains so. And there are not that many lights at night in Soweto. Mm-hmm. So even though there are millions of people around I think it's three quarters of behind where Soccer City is, there's not a lot of light coming out of there at night. And so the thing is just sort of hovering above this sort of dark expanse.
Which is what it's doing institutionally in any case.
Yes, right? Yes, that's true. It's true that there are, we've dealt with that a lot, of course, on the show. And for people who maybe haven't made the connection too much, one of the reasons that Greece has tumbled into this massive economic crisis is because of the tremendous expenditures that they put into the 2004 Olympics in Athens. And so the tremendous amount of debt that the government is carrying is in some part related to the boondoggle that was the 2004 Athens Olympics. And South Africa, while they're not sort of attached to this sort of regional currency that demands certain things about how much deficit it can carry and such like that, could be facing quite a sort of negative windfall because of the expenditures for these stadiums that will have almost no use after the tournament.
That was what I was going to ask. I mean, I think some of them are going to become rugby stadiums.
Right, but they will never really be filled because the rugby doesn't attract that many people, and these are huge stadiums.
They're huge, and I think they will become white elephants.
Mm-hmm.
And it raises the question that this is a city, I mean, not a city, it's a country, that already put on the Rugby World Cup in 1995, which you probably know was
sure,
a hugely important,
yeah.
Right, important political event. And there should have been, it seems to me, more events at places like Ellis Park, which they've refurbished, than building this entirely, you know, new airplane, I guess. It looks like a ship, I think, you know, floating out in the oceans.
It is true they put this out, but I mean I think they saw it as a short-term construction boon, and then what follows afterwards is not only used stadiums that will just decay and not be used, but again it could be quite a debt load that they'll find themselves carrying. Let's talk a little bit about why both of you are here, and let's talk to Daniel first. Tell people out there a little bit about the youth empowerment through Scholastic Sports Services program.
Okay, first of all, this is a program created 10 years ago in MacArthur Park area.
Mm-hmm.
With our problems, one of the big problems we have in there is the system.
Mm-hmm.
The system sounds like they don't like us over there, but we don't care.
Mm-hmm.
We have so far right now 2,000 kids playing soccer in those dangerous streets. I lived there since I get here in this country in 1989, and it's really tough to live there. Every kid go block to block, and every block you go, every kid walk, they ask you, what barrio you're from? That means what gang you related to. So we created this program to have opportunities to the kids, because I took my kid back then to the park, and I asked if they have any program, and they told me yes, but in the way they run it, I don't really total how they run in the program, because they charge a lot of money. So I proposed the city to do this free to the community, and I did free for the two first years. We started with 40 kids, and like I say, now we have 2,000 kids. Has been really tough to create this program.
A lot of our listeners, while we're live on KPFK Radio in Southern California right now, in Santa Barbara, going all the way down to San Diego, going all the way east to Riverside and San Bernardino, the show is also podcast and has an international audience. So maybe let's describe for them MacArthur Park, and also perhaps maybe some people down in San Diego, San Bernardino, aren't that familiar with it. But MacArthur Park, of course, is one of the central old parks of Los Angeles. And in fact, was very central to the city, and it is currently it's just west of downtown, and it is a beautiful park with beautiful buildings surrounding it. And however, it is now the community of people who live around MacArthur Park are largely immigrants, and it's not a rich neighborhood.
Yeah, it's not. We have 47,000 people in a square mile.
Mm.
All these families live in small apartments,
mm-hmm.
four walls only. It's one of the most dangerous parks in the world, I say.
Mm.
Yeah, in the United States, you can see any newspaper. You can go internet and you search something about MacArthur Party, what they talk about.
Mm.
It's where Mara Salvatrucha and old gangs born in the 80s, end of the 80s, about the immigration. So MacArthur Party is a really bad place back then, but now I can say it's a beautiful place because the park has been taken by the families.
Mm-hmm.
Families enjoying this park, and every night you can go and you can see kids playing.
Right.
Yeah, every night from 5 to maybe 9:30 at night, and people there.
And how central is the game of football to this transformation in MacArthur Park?
I think this has been the whole key to the transformation.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we started, MacArthur Park was a lot of gang members there.
Mm-hmm.
And the coach, they got the balls to get there and say, you know what, this park is us. It's for our families.
Mm-hmm.
So we start talking with gang members, say, you know what, you live in the community. This is your brother.
Mm-hmm.
Let us play over here.
Mm-hmm.
Doing this, we have a lot of organizations with money that they don't want to see soccer at MacArthur Park. We have a lot of community meetings, and they say they don't agree to have people playing at MacArthur Park because it was all dirt.
Mm-hmm.
So my question to these people back then is, why they complain about, why never complain about when the gang members have plays at MacArthur Park before?
Mm-hmm.
When all these drug people, these drug dealers make MacArthur Park a center of business to them.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my question about this situation. Somehow the city let me operate my league, let's call my league over there.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, having this program is not only kids having play soccer. This is like we want to change the Latino sense. When in neighborhoods, white neighborhoods, you hear about Latinos, you hear about dirty people with no education. In 10 years, we will provide the city 300,000 hours of community service.
Mm-hmm.
What we do, we have 118 coaches.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids to play at MacArthur Park, they have to give me at least 1 hour of community service per week.
Mm.
They have to get trash bags and pick trash, or they have to remove graffiti, or they have to do anything to create a good atmosphere in the community. So this is how we change in MacArthur Park. And one thing I'm proud of this is that we never ask for money to nobody because we need to show the community here in the USA that Latinos come in and create this as a home. We care. This, for me, this is my home.
Mm.
I have two kids, and I want every kid at MacArthur Park that they don't like their neighborhood they call the ghetto. They say, I live in the ghetto. I want to change that, and I'm sure we change a lot of the lives with this program.
And again, how many, you said 118, how many kids play now?
2,000 kids.
2,000 kids. That is absolutely amazing. And, you know, I'm an immigrant to Los Angeles in that I grew up in the Midwest. And I came to L.A., and for many of the same reasons that the immigrants in MacArthur Park do. I, likewise, I'm an economic immigrant. You know, I came here because the things I decided to do with my life were Los Angeles was a place that provided opportunity for me. And I do have a background where the particular city in America that I come from, St. Louis, for some reason had this great soccer culture. It was sort of unique. The 1950 U.S. World Cup team that defeated England was all made up of St. Louisans. It's a very interesting history about that town. But mainly
And one Haitian.
And one Haitian, very important, scored the goal. And then I grew up in Italy. And I got drawn into the environment around MacArthur Park through some friends of mine, Jennifer Doyle, who's the co-host on the show, and Jonathan. And they introduced me to the soccer in MacArthur Park just in the past few years. And so I've been all around the world, somewhat of a soccer tourist. I grew up, again, partly in Italy along with St. Louis. And I just saw this beautiful environment of people playing soccer in the most sort of, you know, communal and positive environment. So that's just, I think that's utterly fantastic, Daniel.
Thank you. And I want to use this opportunity, maybe any people with power in the city offices is listening to this. It's sad. It's really sad. Because these coaches, they're the one that create this program, not me. I mean, I'm nobody but them. That's the people that put the effort to go every night and practice with the kids, right? My job is go to the offices and ask for permits. And it's with the sad thing coming about this because it's not easy to us get permits. I don't know how they take decisions behind the desk, but they don't know how much they impact the communities. Two days ago, I received this letter saying, I'm sorry we're cutting your hours because the park, I'm talking about Echo Park, need to create their own program. And I go, how come in the news they say they don't have budget to the city, but they want to cut my program and bring another brand new program? They don't have people. They've been trying to do this the last 2 years. It's sad how they push me out and they only bring like maybe two or three kids to play in soccer in one field. It's really sad. Like I say, if it's anybody with power over there, again, I don't ask him for money. I don't ask him for support. I'm just asking to someone to have the power to take decision to help me out to secure my permit every time. Because if they don't have these fields to play, the only thing they have in the neighborhood is gangs.
Well, Daniel, thank you for that. And again, maybe you want to give out contact information for your organization or yourself if you're willing to share that, and maybe people who might be able to help can get in touch with you.
Yeah, my phone number is my cell phone number, 213-220-4938. At the office, 213-353-3058. And we're located at 1833 8th Street, office number 111.
So 213-220-4938.
Correct.
And 213 for the office, 213-353-3058.
Correct.
And the office is, again, on 8th Street.
And Bon Iver.
So Daniel Morales, thank you for all of that. Now, we'll turn to Bob Edelman in a second. But what I want to do first is across this hour, we're going to hear a few clips from an interview that I did earlier today with Richard Williams. Richard Williams is the chief sports writer for The Guardian newspaper and theguardian.co.uk. And for those of you who haven't checked out The Guardian during the World Cup, you really got to check it out. It is something else. I mean, I spoke to the sports editor for guardian.co.uk the other day, Sean Engel, did an interview with him. And, you know, it's based in London, but I think you could combine, and there's been a tremendous amount of coverage between the Times of London, the Telegraph, the Independent, three papers that actually have larger daily circulations than the Guardian. But on the web, the Guardian is king. And you could combine those three papers plus the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the LA Times. They would not add up to the amount of coverage on the Guardian. And right at the center of that is Richard Williams as the chief soccer writer. He's an amazing writer and analyst of the sport. And what we're going to be hearing is my conversation with Richard Williams. You can hear the whole interview with Richard Williams on the website, www.thepeoplesgame.org. But right now we're going to hear a segment of the interview right at the top where we're talking about how the style of football has evolved in international football during this World Cup. In other words, what you're seeing on the field of play, how it differs from previous World Cups. He says the key word is pragmatism. Here is the beginning of my interview with Richard Williams. Now, in your recent writing, Richard Williams, what I've really seen is a really serious effort to sort of analyze how the state of the game at the international level in terms of how it flows. And what I sort of see is a central tenet of what you've brought out, especially as the teams sort of got pared down to fewer and fewer left in the tournament, is a sense that in 2010, international soccer is defined by pragmatism, and yet the one team that really still runs on creative flair is alive, and that's Spain. So your thoughts on how that's evolved?
Well, Alan, I think that's absolutely right. Over the course of the 64 games of the World Cup, of course, you get a very clear view of what's happening at the top of international football, and themes certainly do emerge. I think that's been a slight disappointment this time around, that so many teams seem to be doing the same thing or similar things in similar ways. And of course, one of the joys of the World Cup is the contrast you get of styles between the football from different continents. But of course, now with players crossing national frontiers so much, you know, so many players from Africa and South America and North America too playing in Europe, in the European leagues, it's inevitable that you get a kind of convergence. And of course, we all see so much soccer on the TV now that coaches and players can see what's happening around the world, can take the best of what's happening, can take the best ideas and adapt them to their own thinking. So here in South Africa, the biggest theme to me that's emerged has been the general preference for a 4-2-3-1 formula, which involves using two holding midfield players in front of your four-man defense to provide a screen. Before you begin attacking, if you like, you create this very, very solid rear guard using six players. You know, that's more than half the outfield team to protect your goalkeeper. Now, that's something that's been evolving for several years. You know, I remember being startled when Carlos Alberto Parreira, the Brazil coach, used it to win the World Cup in 1994. Mm-hmm. That seemed a very uncharacteristic thing for Brazilians to do, but it certainly worked. That wasn't the most exhilarating Brazilian team of all time, for sure, but it won the World Cup. And other coaches have picked that up, and now it's become almost universal. It doesn't mean that the football can't be exciting. You still have three created midfield players and one striker, and it depends on how inventive and creative they can be. In the case of Spain, you can see them being very creative. Indeed, it's going to be very interesting on Sunday to contrast that with Holland, who play the same shape, but with a rather different attitude, with a more pragmatic, and that is the most used word of this World Cup, with a more pragmatic attitude.
The words of Richard Williams, the chief sports writer from The Guardian, and we're going to go back and hear another little bit of that interview in a couple minutes, where he talks about Johan Cruyff, the figure who was really the sort of intellectual author, even though he was a player, of really the styles that the Dutch have played for decades, and now the Spanish play, because he brought so-called total football down to Spain through the club side Barcelona when he moved there first as a player and then as a manager. Most of the players on the Spanish team come out of FC Barcelona.
Seven.
Right, yep. And including six starters in the last mm-hmm. game. And their current coach, Pep Guardiola, just says straight up, Cruyff is, I am a disciple of Cruyff. I bring the Cruyff style to FC Barcelona. Bob Edelman, what do you think of Spain-Holland?
I think there's a real possibility that, especially for the intense soccer fan, it could be dull. Precisely for that, you know, sometimes different styles make for interesting fights, they say.
Mm.
And, you know, you don't want to get in a fight with two counterpunchers. Mm. Not that these are, but I think it's going to be very interesting to see who's able to maintain possession. And I think it's very much going to be a game of mistakes, which is why, although I'm supporting the Dutch, I fear for them. Because their defense is not as solid and their goalie is not as solid as Spain's.
Yeah, the goalie seems, there does seem to be a divide between Casillas and the chap for Holland who let in a soft goal against Forlan. And Daniel, what do you think? Spain-Holland?
I think Holland.
Yeah?
Yeah, they have a stronger team. But soccer, I'm an Argentina fan.
But yeah,
anyway. For me, it depends who's going to have a bad day.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I've seen this, like Argentina, the last game that they lost, they just have a bad game.
Mm.
About this game, I think Holland have more chances because they are stronger.
Mm-hmm.
They are stronger, they are taller.
Mm-hmm.
And Spain is built about stars. It's not about team.
Mm.
Holland is about a team for me, in my point of view. So for me, Holland is a team. Mm. Everybody plays.
Mm.
Spain is only like you see the last goal by Puyol.
Mm.
It's all they do.
Mm.
One guy, get up, kick by the head, and it's a goal.
Mm.
But for me, Holland have more chances than Spain in this game.
Okay. Well, let's go back again to the second clip we're going to play from Richard Williams. This is, again, about the role of really one of the great players in the history of soccer, Johan Cruyff. So let's hear more from my interview. You can hear the entire interview with Richard Williams on www.thepeoplesgame.org. Johan Cruyff, it seems almost as much as any point in the course of his lifetime, this is his moment. When for people who aren't familiar, and of course there's a lot of Americans listening here who may not know the detailed history of football from the past century, Cruyff has sort of moved into a position in the pantheon of all-time soccer greats where he's generally mentioned third. Okay, there are great players, Garrincha, Eusebio, who also get mentioned in that territory, but it seems that Pelé and Maradona have sort of occupied this status, and there's the debate, who's the greatest player of all time? And of course, they won World Cups, or a World Cup in Maradona's case, and competed very much for others. Cruyff didn't, only really played in one World Cup, and yet he has this status. And he's somewhat of a sort of cagey, mysterious figure, and I just want to get you to reflect on Johan Cruyff a little bit, his career, his character, and both on the field and off the field as a manager.
Well, Cruyff as a player was like a kind of blinding flash of light when you saw him, like seeing Pelé for the first time. But the difference was, if you were in Britain like I was, that here was a European doing that. You know, before we'd seen Pelé and Di Stefano, who were essentially South Americans. Cruyff played with a degree of freedom and a sort of, I don't know, kind of sense of liberated values that fitted very much with the time, with the late 60s. You know, Total Football came out of Amsterdam, a sort of hippie haven, and reflected a lot of those values. And Cruyff was the figurehead of that. He was a very kind of dashing figure. He fitted into that kind of late 60s, early 70s mold. I wish we'd seen more of him. I wish he, as a player, in a way, I wish he'd sort of stuck around a little bit longer. And I wish he'd gone to the 1978 World Cup. Nobody's ever been exactly sure right. why he didn't, whether it was politics, internal Dutch football politics, or whether the story that he'd had death threats against his family. That having not managed to lead Holland to victory in 74, that would have been his moment. Although, it would have denied us a fantastic victory for Argentina, which was sort of extraordinary, and wouldn't want to have been without that. But
It's the one final I regret the most. I mean, I don't tend to, in a petty way, always bring my politics to bear, but I've always viewed the 78 tournament as a corruption that exceeded the other corruptions.
As tainted by the generals.
Yes.
Yeah, of course, you could see that at the time. That was certainly true, but they had such marvelous players,
right.
Kempes and Ardiles and Luque and Pazzarella, that it was very hard to see them as simply the symbols of a military dictatorship. You know, they were great footballers and a great team,
right.
and they played with such a sense of kind of panache that, in a way, they seemed more like a people's team than a general's team. I thought that's what I felt at the time. Anyway, Cruyff didn't go and deprived himself of that. Of course, he was became a great figure in Spain and identified with the team of Catalonia, Barcelona,
mm-hmm.
and became a kind of presiding deity there, if you like, in the way that Alfredo Di Stefano has always been at Real Madrid. And I think any Barcelona coach sort of operates with one eye on Cruyff, wondering what Cruyff's thinking of him, wondering whether he's doing the right thing in those senses, as I'm sure Pep Guardiola has been doing. He, he's not afraid to speak his mind, Cruyff. I think he said, he said fairly disparaging things about recent Dutch teams. He's quite a harsh judge in a way. You wouldn't mind being in his head on Sunday afternoon to know exactly what he's thinking, where his sympathies lie, because he's been in Spain and been an intimate of the Catalan, the great Catalan club for so long. But his sympathies must be divided.
Yeah, he did come out with a statement today saying that it is a little ambiguous, but the positive, glowing things are said about Spain. But it begins with him saying that I think his heart is with Holland, but, and it goes from there. And then the balance of the content is about how beautiful Spain plays, and they play in the true legacy.
I guess
of Dutch
he can't
football.
Lose. He can say that.
yeah, I suppose it'd be interesting to see. But again, who knows? Again, and he is quite coy in terms of when he does speak out and what kind of interviews he grants and such.
Yeah.
That is my interview with Richard Williams. You can hear the entire interview at www.thepeoplesgame.org. Richard Williams is the chief sports writer for The Guardian. And has a very interesting background, by the way. He was a music writer and critic with Melody Maker and other writings, other journals when he was younger. Worked at Island Records, and he moved from being a, you know, as it were, sort of like a rock and music critic over to being a sports writer. And we talk about that shift. You know, and I grew up in an era where so much of the way that we expressed ourselves was off bouncing off of the music we were listening to. And it's telling now that, you know, a guy like Williams gravitates to writing about soccer, you know, bringing his intelligence to bear there. Yeah.
I think soccer is the new music.
Well, yeah, again, and this thing with the Guardian website, if people haven't checked it out, there's something called the Guardian Fan Network, and they have bloggers from all over the world, and all their tweets appear constantly on the Guardian site from all around the world, and oftentimes they're just trying to outdo each other with wit and insight, you know, and it's an sort of incredible thing to read. Well, this is The People's Game. Axis of Justice, by the way, will be back in a couple weeks. Next week it's going to be Soul Rebel Radio doing a special episode at 7 p.m. on Fridays, and then in 2 weeks' time, the regular show Axis of Justice with Tom Morello, Serge Tankian, and we'll be back here. This is KPFK Radio, 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming around the world at www.kpfk.org. And we are joined right now by my co-host for The People's Game, Jennifer Doyle. And Jennifer Doyle is at a soccer salon that she organizes. Jennifer, welcome to your show.
Hi, Ellen. I hope you can hear me.
Yes, I know. Now, do you want to tell people where you're at?
Yes, I'm at Yucca's on Hollywood. It's many people know Yucca's Tacos in Los Feliz, which is a taco stand, and it's a restaurant version of it on Hollywood Boulevard. And it's owned by Dora Herrera, who's an experienced footballer. She actually played for Brown when she was in college. She used to run the San Gabriel Valley Women's League, actually. So she's a retired footballer and restaurateur, and so she's offered to host our football salon, which is a gathering for Copa Mundial survivors, a place for us to come and work out our anxiety, our nervousness, our depression, any issues that any football related issues that one might have are welcome here.
And so people can come down if they want, right?
Yes, of course. Yes, it's an open forum. It's really just for socializing, and we'll be here at least until 9.
And again, it's a soccer salon. It's at Yucca's on Hollywood at 4666 Hollywood Boulevard. And wow, it is a loud place that you're at right now, Jennifer. So what's on your mind right now? We're 2 days away from the World Cup final, a day away from the third place match. The 2010 soccer orgy is coming to nearing its conclusion. What's on your mind today, Jennifer?
Well, I posted on my blog today a couple pages from a brochure that was left on a friend's car. It was from an evangelical Christian group, basically sort of inviting people to contact this Bible correspondence course as a way to address the sense of emptiness that they would be confronted with at the end of the World Cup.
I know all about it, yeah. I'm dreading Monday.
Yeah, other than that, I'm actually really looking forward to tomorrow's match. I'm actually way more curious about tomorrow's game than I am about the final. I just think that Germany and Uruguay, what do they have to lose? They're both really interesting sides. I could imagine actually it being a pretty energetic and controversial game to a certain extent.
You're contrarian soul, Jennifer.
I am. It's true. I was once described as a non-joiner by a boss. So. yeah, but that's basically what's on my mind. I'm looking forward to tomorrow's game just to see what unfolds between these two sides with a lot of personality.
Well, there certainly are two narrative elements. One is the return of the villainous Suarez, who, in doing what any professional footballer in the world would have done, has managed to. Well, you know, actually, you know, I've said that all along. I said it on the show that the carrying around of him on the shoulders by his teammates after they won in that context probably wasn't such good karma. But he'll be there, of course, tomorrow, or we expect him to be there. And then the other thing is Klose can become the all-time leading goal scorer in the World Cup if he gets 2 goals.
Yeah.
And if it's an open match, that's quite a possibility. And I saw one of the tweets on the Guardian Fan Network where somebody said, one thing for sure about the Uruguay-Germany match, if there is a penalty, Klose will take it.
Yeah, for sure.
Unless Didier Drogba tries.
Yeah. I don't think he's eligible. But
yeah.
I mean, you can't trade players. You can't do player transfers even in neoliberal globalization at this hour. Jennifer, you have no thoughts on the finals you want to share with people?
I'm so burned out. I have a completely empty head when I think about the final, aside from the part of me that was rooting for Barcelona during the Champions League being vaguely interested. So I guess I know it's sort of uncooperative of me to actually not have something really, some juicy tidbit to offer you about Spain and Holland, but I will watch it, and I will watch it with interest. But I think it's an open game in terms of what team is going to walk away with it. I actually don't think there's a strong favorite, and I think these two teams are a bit of a mystery in relation to each other. So any insight that I might offer would be completely, it would be that, the insight of a charlatan.
Well, let me ask you a challenging question that I threw out with Susie Weissman on air in the 5 o'clock hour a little bit, which is, you know, a lot of the sort of FIFA anti-racism information that's put out across the tournament was sparked by incidents that took place in Spain.
Yeah.
And in fact, at games, in particular, one match at the Bernabeu where the Spanish national side played the English national team, and every time the ball went to one of the African English players, the crowd, where there were very audible racist chants. It's a very famous incident, and FIFA getting on board with the anti-racism movement really came right on the heels of that. And the coach of the Spanish side that won the European Championship, Aragon, right, and was the coach in 2006, was caught on mic making racist comments about Thierry Henry. And the Spanish Football Federation did nothing. They kept him on as the coach. They didn't reprimand him at all. And now he's gone. He's no longer the coach. But, you know, is there some bad karma there? I mean, you know, are people giving the Spanish National Football Federation a pass?
I don't know. I mean, I think that real football fans and people who've been following Spain and European football are so deeply cynical when it comes to the National Football Associations, especially with regards to the anti-racist campaigns, that they sort of, you know, look with suspicion upon even FIFA's anti-racist campaign and the genuineness of that, to be quite honest. Because the Football Federation is ultimately run by FIFA, right? It's not run by the Spanish government or the Spanish people. It's administered by FIFA. Right. I mean, it's, you know, that the racist structures of European football are not independent from the old guard bureaucratic structure of FIFA itself. So I'm not sure I would attribute bad karma with regards to that stuff to the Spanish national side. I think that's a bit of a stretch. You know, and one could say, I mean, the Dutch team, the Netherlands, hasn't been immune from its own stories with regards to racism. So. You know, I tend not to want to sort of use that as a guide, a guide for thinking about the way that this match might play out and the way that people might feel about it.
Bob Edelman.
So Jennifer, who do you think Africa's going to be rooting for?
Oh, that's a really good question.
Yeah.
So we have a really good answer.
I'm going to say Spain, but more because I think there's a huge fan base for Barca. You know,
right.
I think that when it comes to the actual players that people have as posters on their walls, you know, that the shirts that kids are wearing, right, that's going to be a lot of the guys who are on the Spanish side, and I think that may sort of draw in people as spectators in a very particular way that I think, again, has more to do with club affiliation than it does with the national one. But this is wild speculation on my part.
Right. Well, what is true, apparently, though, is that Spain actually has a relatively small traveling contingent of fans, and the Dutch have a huge one.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not sure. I actually asked Richard Williams, and he said that he did think, actually, for instance, that the Afrikaner population he said, as far as he could tell, everyone in South Africa, Afrikaner of English descent, black and white, had gotten behind Ghana. And once Ghana was out, though, he was anticipating that a certain segment of the South African population would now fall back in behind the Dutch team because of their roots. But, so I think in the stadium, though, because of that imbalance in terms of the traveling fan contingent, the stadium may sound a little tilted towards Holland.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to actually point to listeners, too, for an interesting story that's making headlines right now with regards to African football. The Nigerian Football Association is back in the headlines again because before Nigeria's matches, players had tried to warn FIFA officials that the team was vulnerable to corruption, meaning that players, they were saying, in essence, people among us have been approached, right, by people who are, by match fixers. And it throws the headlines and the stories that have been in circulation about Nigeria's sort of wild actions with regards to the wanting to actually, like, in essence, you know, clean the slate and get rid of the current team and all of its administrators and start over again and not play internationally for 1 or 2 years. You know, and FIFA reacted extremely negatively and took an activist relationship to preventing that from happening. But this news story raises all kinds of questions about why FIFA would interfere with a government's, a government's investment in trying to figure out and take control over what sounds like a really corrupt situation. You know, so again, I'm the queen of the black helicopter narrative when it comes to FIFA. So I think that anti-racist campaign is a bunch of window dressing over a very corrupt and problematic organization.
Bob Edelman.
Well, actually, you know, they did it with Iraq, too, at one point.
Yeah.
Where they said that, you know, the Iraqi government was getting involved in that. But, you know, there was a very good book that came out about a year or two ago by Declan Hill about match fixing. And he suggested that it was not out of the question by any means. And he had some decent proof that World Cup matches had been fixed. So the idea that Nigeria might have been involved in match fixing is not something that you would dismiss.
Yeah, no, it comes from quite good sources, and it's a very interesting story. And because part of the story are the efforts of players appealing to FIFA to help them, right, be part of an honest squad. So one of the problems in this is that FIFA refuses to pay players directly. Players are played by the Football Association. UEFA, in contrast, actually pays players directly for their participation in UEFA tournaments. And people have spotted this as actually a real weak point in the structure of the World Cup. So I've been really curious about these stories, which actually, you know, hopefully have nothing to do with the next two matches we'll see this weekend.
Well, Jennifer Doyle, thank you so much for joining us here. You are, of course, the co-host of the People's Game. You can check out Jennifer's amazing blog. It is called From a Left Wing. Just Google From a Left Wing. And Jennifer Doyle, we'll see you down at Yucca's in maybe about a half an hour after the show is over. And thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thank you. See you later.
Yep. And right now what I want to do is go back to the third clip we have from the interview with Richard Williams. And in this I actually asked him about what it means to write for The Guardian, which is, of course, known as a progressive left-leaning journal, and what that means to him as a sports writer. I thought, again, here on The People's Game, we were talking to him very much about soccer and the tactics of soccer in the interview. And I always, with everybody we interviewed on the show, we wanted to, again, look at some of the political and cultural subtexts, and that applied to what he does as a Guardian sports writer. I want to ask you now about, what it means to be the sports writer for The Guardian and how The Guardian, if at all, the sort of progressive political bent of the paper, informs your writing or informs the general sports writing. One of the reasons I ask this is because there's so much discourse on the World Cup. It's so immensely popular. It's obviously a highly significant social text and cultural text that humanity participates in right now like nothing else. So, what you make of that, if you bring that to bear at all in your sports writing?
Yeah, I feel I haven't written enough about that side of it or thought enough about that side of it while I've been here, frankly, because you're so occupied with thinking about the matches themselves, going to them, previewing them, watching them, trying to figure out what's happening, trying to tease out the kind of footballing undercurrents that, although one comes here with the best of intentions, some of those, I'm afraid, fall by the wayside. Nevertheless, you can't avoid the, the dissonance between the extreme affluence that's represented by the World Cup, by FIFA in particular, and by all these footballers, many of them extremely rich, coming to a country that is predominantly still extremely poor, where, you know, a huge majority of the population don't have flushing toilets, for instance, where, you know, many of them live in townships in tiny, tiny boxes made out of plywood and cardboard. And you see, of course, you couldn't avoid that even if you wanted to. You know, my second day here, I went to Soweto, which a lot of people have done while they've been here. I tried to go to one of the more remote bits, meet some kids who were playing football and try and see what their lives were like. And it's very, very salutary. Now, a World Cup can't solve that in any way. You hope that by showing South Africa in a good light, maybe there will be more inward investment in the country that can perhaps trickle down to the very poorest people and improve the quality of their lives. You have to question whether FIFA's insistence on building all these huge stadiums is the right way to go about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are two or three stadiums here that will have no serious useful life. They've cost, you know, hundreds of millions. They will have no serious useful life once the circus has packed up its tents and moved on. And I feel that absolutely can't be right, that the reuse and the refurbishment of already perfectly good stadiums like Ellis Park in Johannesburg and Loftus-Versfeld in Pretoria, which are, you know, a big, big rugby stadiums, because rugby, you know, has been the big sport here.
Mm.
That's, you know, a much more sensible thing to do. And just to plonk these gigantic constructions down in places where there can't be a function for them afterwards is wrong.
Now, there's something I haven't seen much made of yet, and I don't know if it's even appropriate that anything should be made of it. I'm not down in South Africa, and I can't say that I'm intricately aware of where the sort of lines of political demarcation lie in the society 16 years after the end of apartheid. But one of the paradoxes of the era, and I was a university student at the time, of the, you know, sort of great divestment movements around the world, the anti-apartheid movements, was you looked at Holland, you looked at the Netherlands, and saw this incredibly liberal society at the time, and then you paid attention to the situation in South Africa, and it certainly seemed like a lot of the people who were most stringently defending the apartheid system had Dutch surnames and were Afrikaners, and it seemed, I'm sure there's a million paradoxes and ambiguities here, that the Afrikaner community was was the part of the white community that was most defending the apartheid system, and that there were roots in that regard. Has any of that come up as an issue around Holland and support for Holland and Holland being in the final?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the brilliant things about this World Cup was after South Africa's own team, Bafana Bafana, were eliminated, the whole of South Africa swung behind Ghana, who eventually were the only remaining representatives of the African continent left in the tournament. And that was fascinating to see. You know, there was a sense to begin with, oh, this is just a bit of PR, you know, a bit of kind of pan-African solidarity public relations hype. But, you know, I talked to lots of people of all kinds, black and white, poor and rich, old and young, and just everybody had swung behind Ghana. And that applied to the Afrikaners, to the descendants of the Dutch settlers of the, I guess, 17th and 18th centuries. I think for Afrikaners now, who speak a language that is a kind of distant variant of Dutch, their Dutch roots are a long way away.
Mm.
I think now that, you know, after Ghana have gone out and, you know, everybody's choosing a side between Spain and Holland, I think inevitably, I noticed in Cape Town at the semi-final, lots of South Africans were choosing Holland, and I guess probably the Dutchness would have something to do with that. But it was just fascinating when Ghana was still here, how absolutely wholehearted they were in supporting them, and how genuine that seemed. That could never happen in Europe. You know, if England were eliminated from a World Cup, you know, the English aren't going to start supporting Germany or France or Italy. That's absolutely unthinkable.
Right.
But here it just seemed the most natural thing in the world and very healthy, I thought.
And that is my interview with Richard Williams, who is the chief sports writer for The Guardian. You can check out his writing at guardian.co.uk. And he just does marvelous analysis of the strategies and tactics, of the 2010 World Cup and football in general. And, you know, it is true about the Dutch and the Dutch fans. I remember in 94 when they were here and then around the world. They actually have really fun time, and they're very magnetic.
And that might also really tilt the stadium towards the Dutch, because I remember in most World Cups that I recall, the Dutch fans really collect a lot of the local fans just because of the spirit of the fans. I think that's also true of the Brazilian fans, you know, but it's always been true of the Dutch that I can remember. So you could have a pretty imbalanced stadium effect there, but we'll have a lot of vuvuzelas. We know that as well.
For sure.
Yeah. And so what's been the response among the people who play down at MacArthur Park to the World Cup? Has everybody been following it closely?
Yes. For the game Mexico-Argentina, we have a big screen that day.
Mm.
And, yeah, they're happy to watch the game. It was about a lot of fights. Because most of the people from them, they're Mexicans. You know. Most Central American people, they are from Argentina.
Did you wear an Argentina? They would have been very courageous for you to wear an Argentina shirt.
Yes. And I get interviewed by Univision.
Right.
And I say that Mexico don't have a chance to win to Argentina, and they get mad at me. But listening to your interview with that guy, you know what? I think real fan soccer don't see colors, don't see political sides. Mm-hmm. Real fan soccer share for teams.
Right, right.
Is what I think.
That's what he said, too, about Argentina, too, because I was very young at the time, and I really hadn't come of age politically, and I remember how exciting the Argentinian fans were. And as I've worn my hair long as a soccer player throughout most of my life, I think back to that Argentinian team because they had such long, flowing hair. And they were such a great team. But as I got older and I read Galeano and I looked back on it and I knew the political history, again, part of the story of Johan Cruyff, who we've spoken about, there's a lot of ambiguity as why he didn't go. But his official public declaration was he would not go to play at a fascist dictatorship. So at times I think that sneaks in. But it's true. The players were great. It was a great team for Argentina in 1978. And Diego Maradona was a young, brilliant, up-and-coming star who didn't make the side that year.
But remember, the coach was something of a leftist.
Mm.
Was it Bilardo or was it Menotti? I forget which.
I think it was Bilardo.
Anyway, so there was tension between the team and the generals. It wasn't simple notion that the players were robots in the pay of the generals by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, another thing that's tough is being an Italian fan. You know, Berlusconi, who's just a rat in my opinion. I'm allowed to say that even as the program director. He's not an American political figure. The guy's a damn rat. And you know, I always find it very disturbing. He's an elected head of state in Italy. It's not like he's not elected. But the whole thing of owning all the media, his corruption, what he signifies within the society. And he was propelled into his political career through football. His national political party, when he developed it, he took the name of the national soccer slogan, Forza Italia. I mean, it's all very cynical abuse of soccer for political ascendancy. And my sense of the Argentinian dictatorship is that victory helped them maintain power.
I'm sure it did.
Right. Yeah,
I'm sure it did. But I don't think, from what I understand, that it was a simple case of a kind of totalitarian system at work. I think there were definitely tensions that maybe didn't surface at the time. We couldn't feel them. I had no sense of them. I was like you. I wanted the Dutch to win, but I didn't think they would. I wasn't that enamored of the way the Argentinians played, but I didn't know anything about football at the time.
Right. No, it was the first World Cup that I had watched in 1974. Of course, Germany played Holland and Germany won. Holland was very unlucky in the 1970s in that they lost two World Cups to the home sides pretty much establishing themselves as the team of the decade. I mean, they lost the 1974 final to West Germany and West Germany. And there are a number of countries, for instance, most notably England and then now France, who've only ever won World Cups on their home soil. In fact, if you look at the 18 World Cups and the teams that have won the World Cups, the winner of this match will be the third team to only have one World Cup. All of the other 16 World Cups are held by multiple winners of the tournament, and Spain or Holland will be the first team to win and only have one World Cup not on their home soil.
I have a question for you guys. Mm-hmm. Put this question on the table. Why do you think most of the Latino countries go for Spain?
Yeah, no, it's a big issue among many of my Latino fans. Most of them seem to be rooting for Spain of the people that I've sort of informally polled.
I'll tell you a story along those lines. In 1970, I was an exchange student in Moscow, and there were a number of, this was before Franco died. Somehow, I'm not exactly sure what the politics of it were, but Spain came to play a friendly in Moscow. And then I had this communist friend who was Spanish, and I said, "Who are you rooting for?" And he said, "Spain." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Blood." You know?
Yourself, do you feel any attachment?
Like I say, for a soccer fan, it's no color or no political side.
Right.
Listen to this. If we talk to people that go to college in Guatemala or any country in Latin America, they don't go for Spain. Reason why? Dictate our goal. It's our saying we have, right? We say we get conquistados by Spain, right? But like I say, people share for teams. People in this situation, as a World Cup, right? So people don't share for political size. They're trying to use the soccer World Cup as a vehicle to have, you know, some kind of advertising political way or something. The people don't care. It's my point of view, personal point of view.
Yeah, I mean, again, for me, it's like, you know, Berlusconi and his ascendancy in Italy, to me, unfortunately, was just such an object lesson because, you know, again, and we talked to Alexander Stile, who's a journalist who reports on Berlusconi's Italy, that, you know, he, when, you know, he was a owner of all this media, he was a former singer, pretty much it was assumed he ascended to his own, his media empire through a lot of sort of corrupt means. And he was the owner of AC Milan, the football club, and the team was the greatest club side in Europe in that era in the early 90s. They had Marco van Basten. They won a succession of European Cup championships, including what's considered perhaps the most dominating single European Cup championship victory in history. Fabio Capello, the current coach of England, was their coach at the time. And he became such a celebrity, and the political figures would come to him to try to gain the glow of his power, and he recognized that he was more important than the politicians, but his next move was then to parlay that into a political career. And right after the early 1970s incredible run of AC Milan was when he was first elected prime minister. So, you know, it does get used, and it definitely got used in the country that is sort of my second home country because I grew up partly in Italy.
So, Alan, do you think the right benefits more from soccer than the left?
No, I think it ebbs and flows. I think in various times the left has. But, you know, at least in our era, unfortunately, and this is a big issue for all of us, which is that the left is just not as well organized as the right. You know, back in the day, that wasn't necessarily the case coming out of the era of great left organizations in the middle of the 20th century. But, you know, it's been used certainly as a source of working class solidarity and anti-colonial solidarity around the world. Its roots remain, and the players, of course, are overwhelmingly of working class origins throughout the world. There are a few countries where that's not true, and largely those are the prosperous social democracies of Europe because they sort of still have maintained in their social democracies a sort of flattening in the creation of a generally middle class society. I mean, there are working classes in Germany and Holland, but it's not the same thing as, you know, it is in the rest of the world in terms of the disparities of wealth.
Well, that goes back to the question I asked you at the beginning, which is, isn't it great that you guys are having this as a show on a station of the left?
Yeah, well, it's the people's game. And the thing, too, is it's so damn popular. You know, I mean, just to throw back to Marxian framings, you talk about communists. You know, where are the international workers of the world? Where are all the people's minds? Are they in the factories? Well, right now they're in front of the TV sets. We know where they are right now, okay? So we should get in the dialogue and think about organizing to create a better society. Daniel Morales, it's been a real pleasure. I'm hoping maybe you can just tell people how to get in contact with your organization one more time.
By phone, 213-220-4938, office 213-353-0038, I'm sorry, 38 is the right number,
313-353-0058, I wrote it down, 213-353-3058, and I want to encourage people to pick up Spartak Moscow, A History of the People's Team in the Worker State, an award-winning book by our other guest today, Robert Edelman.
Thank you so much.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky. And one final thing, because people have called and asked, we will be back live on KPFK 9 a.m. on Sunday before the finals of the World Cup. And then because a host is out of town on Monday at 4 p.m., it looks like our after World Cup wrap-up show live on KPFK will be on the 4 p.m. hour on Monday. So 9 a.m. on Sunday, 4 p.m. on Monday, The People's Game live on KPFK Radio. Thank you so much, Tamika, for your assistance this hour.
You are me.